Hello and welcome to the Money Talk podcast. I'm Ed Monk. Today on the show, we're rounding up the latest news moving markets this week, with particular focus on the growing number of predictions that a market correction is on its way. What, if anything, should you do? We'll also take in the purchase of parts of Debenhams, the department store by online upstart Boohoo. If you enjoy the show, please rate us, share us, or leave a comment wherever you get your podcasts. If you're following the market and investment news cycle right now, it's not hard to see where everyone's attention is focused. Talk is of bubbles and a looming correction for stock markets, with an increasing sense of disbelief that company share prices can still be this high when the economic damage from the pandemic appears so deep. So, will the doomsters be proved right? And if they are, does that mean you should do anything about it? To discuss that, as well as some of the other business news this week, I'm joined by Tom Stevenson, Investment Director here at Fidelity. Tom, you and I spoke only last week about the bearish voices beginning to predict some strife in stock markets. Is it fair to say that those voices are getting louder?
Well, they're certainly getting more numerous. I hardly open a newspaper now without seeing articles about whether we face a correction. I mean, and to be fair, I've written some as well, but it is a fairly common topic in the markets at the moment. People are concerned, and it's not surprising that they're concerned. We've had a very strong rally over the last year, and there is still lots to worry about in the outside world, and it's that disconnect between the two which people are struggling with.
Yeah, and when you say disconnect, I think that's right, and it's that mismatch between where market levels are and what the economy is doing. But it seems to me what's very unusual is the very dismal news on the economy. Markets are high; they're at records in the US, broadly speaking. But it's really that comparison with what the real economy, is doing that makes it seem so out of whack.
Yes, that's right. I mean, all the way through the pandemic last year, investors seemed quite happy to look through the bad news, look through the gloomy headlines, and look towards the what I call the sunlit uplands beyond, and that kind of seemed to make sense. But the longer this goes on, and the threat that the slowdown which inevitably we face in the fourth quarter of last year and the first quarter of this year, which will probably lead to what we call a technical recession, two quarters in a row of falling economic activity, falling GDP. If that were to stretch into the second quarter and the third quarter of the year, then I think people would quite rightly start to question whether their enthusiasm in the stock market continues to make sense. So I've said this, on a number of occasions, sometimes it's better to travel than to arrive. And it's almost as if as we approach the point where people are getting vaccinated, we can see the light at the end of the tunnel. That's almost focused people's attention on the things that are still unfixed, the things that are still problematical. And the state of the economy is clearly one of those.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me, Tom, that as you say there, two quarters of negative growth may well, broadly speaking, be priced in right now. It'll be the third quarter of negative growth or even a fourth quarter. That would be that would not be something that the market expects to happen. And we're going to know about that in the next few months, aren't we? Once we see not just what the first months of 2021 are like, but the months after that in the first half of the year.
Yeah, absolutely. And at the moment, the forecasts are still positive. The forecast is still that after a big downturn in economic activity in 2020, we're going to see growth again this year in 2021, and again next year. If you look at the forecast, we're looking at sort of 6-7% annual growth in big economies like the US. And that is a positive, but it does hinge on the fact that we need to get back to growth in the second and third quarters, and that's the question mark.
Yeah, indeed. So the other side of this, of course, is valuations in the stock market. It's no great revelation, Tom, to hear that parts of the stock market are overvalued by historical comparisons. We've known that for a long time, frankly. But are we really seeing widespread bubble-type behavior that has been the hallmark of previous stock market crashes?
No, I think the key word there is widespread. And that's, I don't think we are seeing widespread bubble behavior. There's no doubt that in pockets of the market, we are seeing, you know, an increase in speculative behavior. You know, we've talked in previous podcasts about Bitcoin. We've talked about Tesla. We talked about technology stocks generally. There are areas of the market where clearly valuations have gone to very high levels, and they are starting to look comparable with the valuations which prevailed, you know, during the dot-com bubble 20 years ago. But if you look more broadly than that, you know, I just don't see that kind of widespread enthusiasm. And we only have to look at our domestic market here in the UK. So over the past 3 years, you know, the FTSE 100 has fallen. I think it's fallen by about 14 or 15% over that period. That is not, for me, evidence of speculative bubble type behaviour.
Yeah, and indeed, I mean, we're actually, the fact that we're discussing a potential stock market bubble, I mean, maybe even that is a sign that there is some caution out there, and that people won't get too far ahead of themselves in general. If it was a real frenzy right now and everyone was very, very positive, that might even be a worse sign, and a sign that we should worry more.
Yes, I mean, I draw a parallel with what happened 20, 25 years ago. You know, actually, the first instances of people starting to talk about, well, the expression then was irrational exuberance. It was the chairman of the Fed, Alan Greenspan, at the time, was warning people that markets were getting too frothy. Now, that wasn't at the end of the bull market. That was in 1996, I think it was, maybe even 1995. But anyway, the bull market still had 3 or 4 years to run before the crash came. So it was very early in the process. So in a way, it's not a concern that people are talking about this. And you're right that maybe the bigger concern is when people have stopped talking about bubbles and they're just getting on with sort of, you know, filling their boots, if you like, with investments, because they see other people making money and they've got this fear of missing out, and they don't want to be on the sidelines when so much money is being made. That's when you really need to start worrying, and that feels like it's a bit further down the track.
Right, yeah, indeed. And I wanted to look at the comparison between now and 2008-09. Obviously, we had a stock market crash then. The crash was certainly far deeper than we saw last year. Obviously, people are talking about the potential for another correction in markets. But the situations are quite different, it seems to me, Tom. I mean, adding to the pessimism back then after the financial crisis was this sense that even if stocks bottom out, economic growth is going to be really restricted because we had this banking sector that wasn't able to lend in the way that it did before. And that just meant that growth after the crash was always likely to be slow. And that maybe made the crash worse back then. This time round has the potential to be different, it seems to me, because we've got parts of the economy and parts of the stock market that are going to, of course, continue to suffer badly, and many areas won't recover there. Pre-pandemic position, but other parts are set quite well, aren't they? That either they've made gains in the pandemic, and their prospects have improved for whatever reason, but there'll also be lots of companies who will have faith that their trading can recover once the pandemic passes. You know, we've spoken about a lot of money sitting on the sidelines right now, a lot of consumers willing and eager to get out there and spend. There's a case for the recovery being quicker in terms of growth this time, and that's perhaps putting a bit of a ceiling, or forgive me, a bit of a floor underneath the stock market, because sure, we might have some froth coming off, but actually, you know, the recovery could be strong.
Yes, I think that, you know, if there are problems with making comparisons with the dot-com bubble of 20 years ago, I think there are even more problems making comparisons with 2008-09. You're absolutely right. You highlight some of the fundamental differences between then and now. The problem back then was a a clogging up of the financial system, a deep recession as a result of banks losing trust in each other, losing trust in lending to companies and individuals. And that meant that the recovery from that drop in the stock market was much slower than it's likely to be this time. Absolutely right. You know, the fundamentals of the economy are not broken this time. Once we can see light at the end of the tunnel of the pandemic, then, you know, there's no reason why growth cannot return quite quickly to levels that it was before. And certain areas of the market, which actually are beneficiaries of what's happened over the last year. So it is, it's a completely different situation.
Yeah. Nonetheless, Tom, of course, investors looking at all this are going to be worried. How should they approach, the prospect of a correction? You wrote this week about the difficulty in handling corrections as an investor. We don't know, of course, that is what we're going to get. But what, broadly speaking, are the options facing investors right now?
Well, the options are that you worry about a correction ahead, and that you protect your portfolio from that potential correction, and you withdraw from the market. That's one option. It's a very dangerous option, frankly, because as we've discussed on many occasions before, if you leave the market, you have to, that's the first decision. You then need to make a second decision, which is when to get back into the market. And that is extremely difficult to do. And most people do not do it successfully. They leave it too late. So timing the market is notoriously problematical and difficult for investors. So you know, in a piece that I wrote earlier this week, I said, yes, I really think that there is a possibility that we will get a stock market correction, or at least in certain quarters of the stock market, we will get a correction. But for longer term investors, they need to look through that, and they need to look at history and realize that these kinds of corrections are part and parcel of just the normal run of stock markets. In 2010, the year after the market bottomed, after the financial crisis, we had a 16% correction in the stock market. Now, if you imagine living through a 16% fall in the stock market, that's pretty worrying. That's pretty painful. But the market went on in the subsequent years to double and triple from there. So, you know, it's a real warning that, don't try and be too cute about timing the market, because it's very difficult, and there is a danger that you will miss out on subsequent gains.
Yeah. And the thing that always occurs to me when we have this discussion, Tom, is that, I think we can all kind of build this narrative in our head that there's this, you're the one that you sell out just before it all falls, and then you get back in, even if you have sort of courage and confidence to make those decisions in the first place. It is very, very unlikely that you'll time it right, not just once when it falls, but also again once it starts rising again. So you have to factor in a sort of a round trip, if you like, of what this is going to do to the value of the assets that you hold. You've got to think, well, you're probably not going to get the top completely right, you're not going to get the bottom completely right. So at what point do you just say, well, actually it's easier, and it's certainly easier psychologically, to stay in for the long haul?
Yeah, and you know what? We all like to think that we're better drivers than the average, and better at all sorts of things than the average. By definition, that's not true. That's why it's an average. And the chances of us being worse than the average at timing the market are just as good as being better than the average. And we should be humble enough to realise that that's probably the case.
Yeah, indeed. And just finally on this story then, Tom, if someone were happy to, broadly speaking, leave the levels of money they have invested in shares where they are now, so they're not going to make any big wholesale movements in and out, are there ways that they could skew their holdings more towards undervalued parts of the market that are certainly not in bubble territory.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you and I recorded an interview earlier this week, actually, with one of our value-focused fund managers, Alex Wright, who runs the Fidelity Special Situations Fund. And he was talking about the relative valuations of different markets. And he, of course, is an investor in the UK market. And he was pointing towards the average price compared to the average earnings of the UK market, the so-called PE ratio, and saying it's materially cheaper. I think he said about 12 and a half times earnings, expected earnings in the UK compared to about 15 times in Europe, the rest of Europe. And of course, we know that the US market is much more highly valued than that. So I think that, you know, one thing that investors can do is they can look around the world at the relative valuations of market and just, you know, at the margin, skew their portfolios towards the cheaper markets like the UK, like parts of Europe, maybe like Japan. You know, you don't have to do it wholesale. You don't have to completely withdraw from the more expensive markets, but you can just slightly shift the balance.
Okay. Well, Tom, no doubt that one will be a recurring theme. But I wanted to move on, if we may, because there's something else I wanted to talk to you about today. And that's some news that we've had in the retail sector. Now, this is to do with Boohoo, which is the online fashion retailer, and it's going to pay £55 million for the intellectual property of Debenhams, the famous department store here in the UK, which of course went into administration last year. The deal excludes bricks and mortar stores, so no more Debenhams on the high street that we're familiar with seeing. Boohoo is just taking the online operations of Debenhams. There's also another deal in the offing for ASOS, which of course is another large internet fashion house, to buy chunks of the Arcadia Group. That's the company that owns Topshop and Topman. Similar story. ASOS is only interested in the online operations here. Tom, these stories seem to really encapsulate the shift from the real world of bricks and mortar high street retail to online, and the trend seems fairly definitive by this point.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, isn't it interesting that, you know, neither Boohoo nor ASOS is remotely interested in the actual high street shops? And that is telling us a story about, you know, where they anticipate the growth being. You know, there has been and there continues to be a massive shift away from, you know, bricks and mortar shopping towards shopping online. We all do it. And so, you know, not surprising. I think one of the interesting aspects of this story actually is, though, that it suggests that the likes of Boohoo, which have been very narrowly focused as clothes retailers, are thinking more broadly about the opportunity in online retail. And in a way, they're kind of taking on the Amazon approach of saying, you know, we want to become a one-stop shop for online retail. We want to sell clothes, but we also want to sell, you know, homewares and other things. So in a way, yeah, they're taking the department store model and moving it online. That's an interesting development.
Yeah, it is, because I guess it sort of reminds us that things like brand and familiarity and trust, you know, they are still important, aren't they? We can sometimes fall into the trap of thinking, well, basically Amazon, for example, just owns the world of online retailing and everyone's just going to have to fit around it. But there are companies out there that are keen to put up some competition against the real big boys.
Yes, and actually, well, we've talked a bit about what happened 20 years ago, and it's just interesting to just remember what happened there. I can remember in that sort of first phase of excitement about the internet, everyone thought, oh, well, the internet is a great sort of democratizing influence, and you know, anyone can set up a shop on the internet, and won't that be fantastic? The reality is that actually the internet entrenched the positions of the dominant players, because as you say, they were brands which we trusted. It doesn't matter whether you're walking down a high street or you're online, and perhaps more so online actually, because it feels like a bit of a Wild West sometimes. You actually want to be reassured by the trust in the brands that you know.
Yeah, indeed. And Tom, the real reason I wanted to talk about that story, you know, it's interesting in and of itself. But I think it does say something about how these big trends that we talk about, which could affect economies and affect markets, they happen over a long period of time, but then they hit a tipping point and then they happen very quickly. You know, we've known about this trend towards online for decades, really, probably 20 years. You know, you could have predicted that this is going to happen. But as we've seen, it really seems to have accelerated in the last year. And we know why, because of the pandemic and because of, you know, everyone being at home and operating their lives so much more online. But it does tell us, doesn't it, about how these trends tend to work. You can know about them in advance, but they pick up speed rapidly.
Yes, well, there's that famous expression, isn't there? You know, sort of, how did you go bankrupt? Very slowly and then very quickly. And, you know, it's true that these trends are around and you're half aware of them. And then suddenly something happens like the pandemic and everything is accelerated. So a lot of these trends, I mean, the things about, you know, office working and online shopping, they're things that were happening anyway. They probably would have happened over a period of 5 to 10 years. They've just happened. Happened in 1 to 2 years instead.
Yeah, and you could add to the list, you know, we speak a lot about sustainability and the shift towards companies that are sustainable in the long term versus not. That you could talk about, I don't know, rising middle class consumerism in the developing world. You could talk about, yeah, this online trend. They're everywhere, and you've got to kind of factor them in. Even when you don't think necessarily that they're going to change tomorrow.
Yes, because they may creep up on you and happen very quickly. We've talked about this when we've had conversations about the difference between value and growth investing, saying that, you know, sometimes the recovery in value stocks can be very explosive and very quick. If you're not prepared, if you're not positioned for that, very easy to miss the boat.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, well, Tom, we've covered lots today, so we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining me.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the Money Talk podcast. Check fidelity.co.uk for daily written updates and articles on these and other topics from across Fidelity in the UK. And subscribe via iTunes to get the podcast downloaded direct to your devices every week. Please be aware that the value of investments and the income you get from them can go down as well as up, so you may not get back what you invest. This information doesn't constitute investment advice and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision, nor should it be treated as a recommendation for any investment. Eligibility to invest in an ISA or a pension and the value of tax savings depends on personal circumstances, and all tax rules may change. You will not normally be able to access money held in a pension until the age of 55. Reference to specific securities or funds should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell these securities or funds and is included for the purpose of illustration only. Fidelity Personal Investing does not give personal recommendations. If you're unsure about the suitability of an investment, you should speak to an authorised financial advisor.